it's 2024 now. Why can't we have the conversation of, okay, how far have we come? What next?
Hi, I'm Brooke Milhouse. Welcome to Disabled and Proud, the podcast that does exactly what it says on the tin. Each week, the show highlights an awesome disabled guest speaking about their own disability, why they're proud to be disabled, and why they're proud to be themselves.
Lydia, welcome to Disabled and Proud. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. I must admit, I am a bit cold and a bit wet due to the sort of rain situation that's going on in West Sussex, but we're not going to talk about that.
Today has been one of those days where it's like, everything's all got to be done at once and let's get it going and let's get it going. And actually, I'm really glad that we've got some time just to sit and just to chat and talk about all things disability and being an author. So without further ado, that is what I mean. The first question that I ask absolutely everybody is, how do you refer to your disability?
So I prefer the term disabled person. And that is for a number of different reasons. So I like to joke that I have an alphabet of disabilities now, the older I get. So I was originally diagnosed as an autistic individual. I was 2 months shy of turning 16 at the time.
Yeah.
So for the majority of my life, I just had that single condition. 2 years ago, nearly 2 years to the day, in fact, I caught coronavirus. And ever since then, it's been kind of like, it's becoming a little bit of a joke, really. I go to a consultant, doctor's office, whatever, and it's something that, oh, yeah, here's another one that you can add to the list.
Yeah.
And it's also the thing of where it really irritates me in the sense of, no matter in the sense of my output, anything vaguely positive that I achieve as a journalist, it's always reduced to me being, it's just the thing of, I always get written about as autistic journalist. Yeah. It's not an adjective. You wouldn't say, oh, that, like, you know, boarding broadcaster who just happens to do something about sports.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen to a guy. It never happens. It's always the women who are just reduced to that because apparently we tick a diversity box.
Yeah, and there's so much to be said in diversity and box ticking, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But as you said, so you were, what, 16 when you got your autism diagnosis?
2 months shy of turning. So it was it was one of those things where, so it took around 3.5 years to get to the point, but it added, there was almost another year on, basically, because so you have the report done and then somebody has to write it up. There was not somebody available for a year to do that.
Wow.
So it was the thing of where you get the letter and it says, oh, you're autistic, but then you have the kind of like, I guess you could call it the sort of the sign-off point. So you have one last thing and just, it's basically to say, do you have any questions? At the age of kind of 15, 16, it's also massively awkward because there's no real service post 16, post 18. So it was basically, oh, you're autistic, bye. We've got nothing else to say after this. So I always say from the point of the last session, just because that was sort of, you know, everything was officially signed off and all that kind of thing.
And that age is so formative as well. Like, I always say this, you couldn't pay me to go back and be a teenager. But having that experience during your teen years, what was that like in terms of like how it shaped how you look at disability and how you like moved through that diagnosis and going forwards?
I find that's such a good question. Nobody's asked me this before, apart from a friend of mine. If I say there were kind of two positive turning points in terms of disability, simply because it irritates me in the sense of neurodiversity has become this majorly kind of capitalistic advantageous concept, in that it's always put as, oh, they have this superpower so that they're good in the workplace. But the thing about this is it's also highly gendered. There is research that shows autistic women speaking here as well, that there is a gender gap when it's autistic individuals in the workplace. Even if you've got the superpower factor in, it's just, it does not take into account nuance in the way it's presented.
Yeah.
Added to that, a lot of organizations, I've noticed, they start using the language of neurodiversity to dodge their legal obligations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the thing that I basically was told, you're a bit different, bye. Mm-hmm. But we're not gonna, they tell you the sort of like the how as to why you are the way you are, but you were never ever told how to cope or just strategies. It was also a bit kind of ridiculous because the way it was done for me was to basically get me through my GCSEs.
Yeah.
There was no kind of future planning, and I still mm-hmm. feel, frankly, a little bit resentful. I did not have a particularly good time in education. I hated mm-hmm. being in it. I don't really have anything positive to say because it was the thing where teachers would enable pupils would enable the teachers to be discriminatory. I was always the individual who kind of had like the sort of like, I would make friends with the different individuals and we'd have kind of like our gang in the corner. The sort of the very quite nerdy sort of stereotype. So the second kind of formative experience I had, I don't know how much I can get into this. So when I thought, I did my A-levels and then did an NCTJ and that was kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
I went freelance from the moment that I completed my NCTJ, basically out of necessity, really. Journalism is very exclusive as a profession, and I'm really sick and tired of conversations that go, oh yeah, what is diversity and what do we mean by this? What can we do about it? It's 2024 now. Why can't we have the conversation of, okay, how far we come, what next, rather than sort of pontificating? And like, you know, I just have this image of kind of like, you know, sort of professors with the long white beard sort of typing at a typewriter and being sort of very academic about it.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of fell into this. I used to work for an organization, it doesn't exist, it's since sort of gone into something, a kind of different sort of repackaged outlet. I was covering the thalidomide crisis. And that happened by accident, basically because I saw there was a documentary on Netflix called Attacking the Devil, Sir Harold Evans and the Last Nazi War Crime. Mm-hmm. It is a brilliant documentary. I had this, I was watching this while I was sick with a relative of mine, and they have what we like to joke about and call it autism radar. They have a 99% accuracy, whereas I do not. And they are neurotypical. So when the former editor of the Sunday Times came on the screen, Harold Evans, all I just remember is kind of like their face sort of turning to me sort of almost instantly and going, Lydia, that man, I think he's autistic. I don't know how, I just know, sort of with the finger pointing and all that. It's the really selfish thing. I started to sort of look at the Sunday Times because I had no idea what this sort of really was. It wasn't talked about. I was the youngest on my NCTJ course. Like, I was properly.
Yeah.
So I went and I was given a copy of his autobiography for Christmas. This is Christmas 2017. And it's the thing where whenever I meet people, I always have like 100 questions that I want to ask people.
Yeah.
Journalism's free license to get away with actually asking this. So I asked to interview Harry. So that took place in, I think it was around February 2018, just trying to do the timings. It occurred to me that the Sunday Times is not the story that we should be telling. We have this idea that journalism has this kind of like golden, gilded age type thing. It's a kind of a faux nostalgia. And if you talk to kind of like old guard journalists today, it's always the thing of, oh, it was always better in my day, even though their day was not this sort of golden age period. It's very often afterwards, don't tell them that. So I interviewed Harold Evans. I went to interview, there is a woman who is a thalidomide campaigner. I went to her house because it's just the thing of where there are around 430 individuals who are thalidomide affected alive today from the UK, and yet their story has not effectively been told. I was far more interested. And I think we do this with disability a lot, in the sense of, And it just, it drives me mad, because it's always the thing of, oh, we spoke to the parent, we spoke to the guardian of this person this story is about, never the person who's actually affected.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, we would not do this about any other protected characteristic. So why do we do it with disabled individuals? Is it because you infantilize us? Yes, it probably is. So I just remember being sat in this individual's house, and she had this absolutely wonderful, powerful way of speaking. She speaks in Parliament quite a lot. But it was the thing where she says, I have been treated with suspicion my whole life. She was referring to her upper limb disability, because she, for the first time really, she was sort of talking about actually putting the sort of her access needs out there, because I'd asked the question, rather than just sort of saying kind of like, oh, what did you think about this thing that happened journalistically? And then she finished this by saying, and I think you have too. Because she, so I don't know how she did this, but she sort of worked out really quickly that I was on the autistic spectrum.
Yeah.
I feel that was very formative, in the sense of, it still really massively irritates me, in the sense of how we do disability when covering it, but how we also talk about it. So rather than sort of, we did a thing of kind of like shock and outrage. I saw just before I logged on, there is yet another story on the Independent that's saying about forced do not resuscitate notices that were issued during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah.
Why is this a surprise, non-disabled people? This is about kind of like round six or seven in the last 4 years that you have shown us this. We were warning about that. We told you about this. And I know many people who were in fact pitching this to their editors going, we should be covering this. Oh, but we don't talk about that. Because why? Because it's unsavory. So it's like, you know, racism, sexism and all the rest of it. Just sort of, oh, no.
It's really interesting that you bring up that particular topic, because I worked with adults with learning disabilities during the pandemic, and that's like a big part of my life. And that was always my biggest fear, that if any of my clients ended up in hospital, there was an automatic DNR put on all of their care files. And obviously, like, for those who don't know, like a care plan and a DNR are legal binding. You can't break them. And if you do break them, there is chance for you to go to court and be sued and go to prison if you do not enforce what is on the care plan, which is right. But when we're thinking about DNR, and it's an enforced DNR, it wasn't chosen, it was enforced. As soon as you were in hospital, it was slapped on your record. And it's a lot of legal work to try and get that taken off if it's on there wrongly and rightly. And when we're thinking about the pandemic, like, there was no way that anybody was going to get that removed.
It was also done for a lot of autistic individuals, because very often, for no particular good reason, there's still this fundamental misunderstanding that learning disability and autism are the same thing. When they're actually not. One's in neurology and one is a completely different thing. So I really want to shout about this. So there are two amazing women who I think we owe a lot to. There's Dr. Sarah Ryan, for example. So her son, Connor died in a trust, and she campaigned with the Justice for Laughing Boy campaign. She wrote a book about it, and she does a hell of a lot of work around trying to change this. So rather than just sort of going, just train these people just to do better, because, like, if you train people, you can't, like, do this. Actually sort of taking the time to address this. There's also the wonderful journalist George Julian is a hero of mine, because she is just such a wonderful individual. She is a crowdfunded journalist, and she goes to the inquest about what happens afterwards. There's all these stories currently about, oh, such and such a coroner has warned about this particular area of the NHS trust. And yet this is never truly dealt with. There are so many missed opportunities. We have been here before. Why is it such a surprise to the non-disabled individuals as to the DNR notices? It's because you weren't listening. We told you this a decade ago. George Julian sits through all the court hearings, live tweeting, and she does the blog post write up afterwards. There was just such this, am I allowed to swear on this?
Oh yeah, go ahead.
I'm quoting, it's not me, just in case my mother's listening. She did this wonderful, there was a case where relatively quite close to where I live in Brighton recently, and it was an individual who had gone to an inquest, and she had, I think she'd been sectioned or something like that and had not been adequately cared for. I cannot quite remember the full outline. Her mum had found, there was a note that she left behind on the notes app on her phone, that there was such a brilliant iron in this, where it said, "Mum, this is," it was effectively saying, "Mum, this is not your fault. After this, I want you to tell my story and shout it from the fucking rooftops."
Yeah.
Now, if that's not an impetus to for us to do better, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and I completely and wholeheartedly agree with that, because I think there's so much to be said. Even when we look, like, what, quite recently, I'm going to say it was like, what, a month, maybe 2 months ago, was it Bristol Council? And they wanted to disabled people in their homes and in their care homes.
Because it's cheaper.
But make it legal. And you know, when we talk about this, we're talking about this obviously quite freely.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there are people out there who thought that that was acceptable is alarming. But as you said, like, these conversations have been going on for years and years and years. And the fact that the only reason it hit headlines was because people were like, we're standing up against this, and it's against human rights to lock people in their rooms. And how do you think, as you said, in the year of 2024, that that's acceptable to treat disabled people like that? But why are you also shocked? Because we've been talking about it for so long. It's nothing new, and we're here having this conversation yet again. So why are you outraged? You should be on our side, fighting with us and fighting for us.
It's the thing, outrage, I think, is costly because it doesn't actually do anything productive. So
yeah,
there are two things about the Bristol related story that I'd like to touch upon in response to this. So I think that part of the reason, I think, is that there is sort of this, I don't know if you've come across that, I think we've talked about this before, you and I, in the US they had that what was called the ugly laws about 100
years
ago. Yes, the
ugly laws, yeah.
So the ugly laws in the US basically said, oh, this person is ugly in the sense of they are physically disabled,
yeah,
and all the rest of it, so they're not allowed in public. We are seeing kind of like an indirect offshoot of this quite often. So whether it's Donald Trump mocking a disabled reporter, or even just sort of the way in which we talk about kind of, so very often it's sort of, oh, those SEN children, they're just a bit naughty and it's bad parenting, it's always the mother's fault.
Yeah.
That very often happens. It's such a kind of offshoot. And when you start to ask the question of these particular individuals, have you ever met a disabled person? Very often they say no. So they come out with all this just kind of ridiculous bile. I think that we are seeing kind of an offshoot of that in the way that we sort of stigmatize. And the second thing I want to say about this, it becomes complicit with media that is exclusive. Media shapes our cultural wallpaper. It is what we talk about. It is what you see on Twitter and all the rest of it. The thing that we talk about, I mean, right now, at the time that we're recording, for example, there's been the whole sort of ridiculous fuss about Kate Middleton and the doctored pictures.
Yeah.
You would not be talking about that if it wasn't for journalists who were reporting, going, hold on a second, what's gone here? But the thing is, journalism is chronic. First of all, it's chronically underfunded, meaning that it becomes vulnerable because of a flawed business model. Second of all, it's also, for this particular reason, it's very, very exclusive. I would borrow an old expression to say it's sort of like an old boys club.
Yes. Yeah.
There is media ableism that is ingrained in there, and it becomes, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry, my phone just did the same thing.
I just find this really funny. And so as I'm sort of talking about the stereotype of kind of like old white male, university educated, that is exactly who's just texted me. And the thing is, his nickname, he seems to enjoy this too much, his nickname is actually Lucifer.
We love that for him. Good for Lucifer.
but it's the thing, but I'll come back to this. It's the thing where we become complicit just by sheer proxy. And I say this in the respect of, I recently, for the last sort of 18 months, I've sort of been researching to find myself a book agent, which I've managed in the last kind of 6 weeks, I've managed to finally do. It took a lot of research, and I actually ended up pitching to about 25 different book agents about the concept of disability.
Yeah.
So the majority of them said no, simply because the topic of disability was frankly unpalatable. It was not seen as being profitable enough. But when I was sat in kind of courtrooms, coroner's courts and all the rest of them, it's really quite alienating, but it's also very interesting because I am sort of palatable in the sense of, unless I'm using my cane, you would not know that I have various disabilities.
Yeah.
So I had this experience where I was sort of kind of like eavesdropping into this whole other universe that I very rarely get to be a part of. So I will not forget the names of my colleagues on the press benches who were using language that was so outdated, it was genuinely quite shocking.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of, I won't use the expressions, but it was the thing was sort of, I'm not able to moderate that while I'm having a job to do. The copy that was written, it was horrible. And it was basically, it was the thing very often, even though the judge was, in this particular case, he was very good to say, autistic people are not violent just by sheer proxy of their diagnosis. They're not just going to be. Somehow that got changed into kind of an indirect write-up of kind of going, oh, like, you know, they're all like violent criminals and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's the thing of, we become complicit simply because we're vulnerable. And I think that we need to actually, we spend a lot of time going, what is the future of to be a journalist or an industry as a whole? Why would anyone who is vaguely ticking the box that says different going to buy into something that is exclusive, the second most exclusive profession? They wouldn't do. It's just sort of this, hundreds of thousands of pounds is being spent on this question all the time to say, what can we do about lost readership? Cover the story that matters to them, for fuck's sake. Like, it's, you don't really need to be kind of like, it's not even vaguely intellectual, it's just stating the absolute obvious, isn't it?
I really like what you said just then about, what was it you said? Something about being complicit, like we're complicit because we're vulnerable. And I think there's so much to be said around that topic, because you're right. People who feel vulnerable and who feel like, you know, are in danger of being exposed, you won't necessarily go against the grain. Not because you don't want to, but because you're in a vulnerable place and you're in a vulnerable position. And it takes a lot of grit and a lot of guts to go against that. And if you can do that, that's incredible. And it's about, you're right, it's about that like elitist movement. Like, you're right, journalism is an incredibly difficult place to talk about disability and be paid for it. And actually to cover stories that are important to disabled people and talk about the issues that disabled people face, because you're right, it's not palatable. Because somehow we've somehow equated with being, you know, disability
monstrous.
And it's quite, and it can be quite unsavory. And these conversations that we're having aren't, you know, they're not pretty and they're not nice. And actually, well, you kind of got to face the reality that actually sometimes being disabled, it isn't pretty and it isn't nice, but this is what we're faced with. But we need to be able to have these conversations just to show that everybody else, that we have the same lives. We have the same struggles as everybody else, but they just look a little bit different. But because you kind of slap that disabled badge on it, it becomes something completely different.
Exactly that. I had this, just to illustrate this further. I know he's not going to listen to this because he presents podcasts, but I don't think he would listen to this sort of subject. I had a brilliant conversation with an editor of mine. I'm not going to identify who this person was. Me in this area, I would describe it as being upper class. It's the sort of thing where I am just very aware that, as I'm telling you this, that this comes across as being massively privileged. I'm just very aware that I'm a white woman with a laptop saying this. It's the sort of area, you know, the feeling of when you go into somewhere like Kurt Geiger or something like that, and you always feel just that little bit shabby, and sort of they've always got like the very thin very chic assistant and all that kind of thing. It's that kind of place. It was just covered in silk and lights, and it was very expensive. There was a lot of money in this area. So the thing was, he had not seen me for 18 months for various reasons, and I was not aware of this. Nobody had told him how COVID had affected me. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought to say, hold on a second, you might want to consider this, which did make me laugh. So it was the thing of where I was in a, my friends found this really funny at the time, I was in a fuck this mood, because I'm not going, I'm at the point in my life where you're not going to make me feel small anymore. I'm mm-hmm. sick of sort of, we, it's a very difficult thing sometimes to have to kind of to juggle the hats. So disabled person, take that off. Journalist, they, I feel that they have to be very distinct and very separate. So I had my Neo book cane with me, because it's the thing of sometimes it's really hard for me to stand up and to keep going, because I have three different chronic conditions, and the fourth that's monitored in case it comes back. So I my cane is really glittery, it automatically stands out, but because of the fuck this mood, I thought, okay, I'm going to put this on the brightest setting possible, just to sort of draw attention, going, yeah, I'm here, you're not going to make, you're not going to squash me. And it was just this wonderful thing. I walked in and there was just this sort of quick second glance, his face cracked with the sort of feeling of, okay, what do I do and how do I handle this? It was just great just to see that little. We had an educate, it's a learning, I feel, just to sort of, just to, even just to be visible. We should not have to be, disabled people are not your free resource. We don't, it's just this idea of, I still have people who come up to me, complete strangers, who go, oh, what happened to you? Because they don't have the language to talk with nuance. So disability, for example, can be acquired, it can be from birth, it can be developed, etc. They do not have this vocabulary. My disability is not an accident. It came through a pandemic because my body reacted badly. But it's just the thing, it's the thing of, I do not exist, you do not exist, in the sense of just to be somebody's textbook. If you're curious, go use Google.
And that's a really important point that you've just hit on, is that disabled people are not your free resource, and so often we are asked to educate for free, and we're asked to give talks for free, and we're asked to write things for free, because people feel like, just because we're disabled, it's almost like it's our duty to help educate everybody else, when actually we're experts by experience, and therefore that expertise demands payment. I mean,
you should be paid.
I wouldn't ring up an electrician, ask him to fix my lights, and then be like, oh, like, just because you're an electrician, you're gonna do it for free, because you know, like, that's just, it's just a good thing to do. Like, I would never do that. And we've kind of layered that in with disability somehow, and it's so aged, and it's so wrong.
It's,
but
yeah,
we're
really
still
gendered.
Having these conversations. Yeah,
it's the thing about, I had this email, this is about, about a month and a half ago, I think. I was invited to a conference to do with media. I was invited because I was a journalist, so I was told that there was no fee attached to this, but the selling point of this was that it was a ticketed event and ticket sales would be donated to causes. That is admirable, in that you're raising for whatever cause you like and you're able to do that. But there's such a kind of a catch-22. And I even wrote back to say, you would have never have written to a bloke to have asked for that. This is massively inappropriate. And it's also kind of ironic, given what your conference is about. It's the thing of where, women are always expected to be kind of the altruistic. We're expected to give and give and give. Mm-hmm. I came across this amazing statistic recently. This is by Catherine Rambles on a podcast. I think it was Happy Place by Fern Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. I will look this up to send to, so you can put it in your show notes after this. But she pointed out that the emotional labor, so all the unpaid tasks of women, when you actually measure it, it's actually the GDPR equivalent of places like China.
Yeah. Wow. So
if we just think about that for a second,
mm-hmm.
we have built a society that is basically built on the backs of free labor, and we call ourselves democratic. There is something really quite gendered in that we are disabled women are always expected to kind of like do the thing of speak freely for a cause and all that, mm-hmm. despite the fact said cause may be making money off of this. And then it's the thing of if you, there's to make a wider point in the sense of there's such a stereotype around kind of like scroungers and that sort of thing. So if you do the free work, you are not technically working, so therefore you are a scrounger. However, mm-hmm. if you do the work and then you demand a fee, then you sort of become this sort of, you're a massive bitch kind of stereotype.
Problematic, like, disabled woman. Yeah.
She's a bit awkward and like, you know, she's a bit mouthy and outspoken, that sort of thing. There is no kind of nuance on these very polar extremes at all. And mm-hmm. it's so problematic. So organizations that want to talk about diversity or to take advantage, just, you know, it's the lip service element as well. We cannot possibly have, it just struck me in the sense of we've now had 5 years of where we've had this conversation about what allyship means, what mm-hmm. it is, and how not to be performative, how to make it intersectional. Disabled individuals are basically never considered as an intersection. And if they are, it's always non-disabled people speaking over us.
Yeah.
So just to give you an example, in the book that I'm researching to write next, in the respect of the Sarah Everard backlash, in the respect of when the Metropolitan Police came out with that ridiculous statement going, if you fear a policeman is doing this and you're at risk, just run for a bus. Disabled women can't run for a bus. I cannot think of a single disabled individual who was given the platform, time, or just the continuity to make this point, or he was even consulted as that is their speciality. It was always the kind of political football of other figureheads who go, but think of the disabled. They're so pitiful and, you know, sort of tap them on the head type thing. There is nothing in that kind of universe that even considers us just for a second, even though we are more at risk.
Yeah.
Just think, if we just actually think about that for a second, that's actually quite a powerful thing. We need to work on this. Disabled women have done a lot for society generally, not just in the kind of disability space. It's time we should be paid. We should be given our dues. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
No, and it's very, very true. But interestingly, you were talking about writing a second book, but
yes.
I want to talk about your first book that you wrote, because I find that it should have been written a lot sooner. That's not to take away from your idea, but the idea should have been sought out sooner than it was. And that's no dislike credit to you at all, because I think what you wrote was absolutely brilliant. And if you could just dive in a little bit as to what you wrote and as to why you wrote it, and how it benefits people, would be really wonderful.
The Autism Friendly Cookbook basically happened because I was majorly bored and also pretty pissed off during the first lockdown. It's the thing where I get the word sensitive thrown at me a lot, or kind of like, apparently I'm an activist. That's not how I would describe myself.
Mm-hmm.
But if in this sort of sense, it definitely was sort of like a counterculture reaction. May 2020, I was made aware that I was eligible for personal independence payment.
Mm-hmm.
And I say made aware in the respect of, basically prior to that, I had had no real support whatsoever in respect of my autism spectrum disorder,
mm-hmm.
simply because I was at an awkward age. And so the process started of applying. I knew from previous experience how bad this was. So when I sort of touched upon earlier doing a lot around kind of thalidomide and that sort of thing, there is an individual who was written about in the Daily Mirror not that long ago who had his PIP stopped because apparently this individual who had no arms and no legs could just somehow work.
Yeah.
And all that kind of thing. There's been stories about where other individuals have had amputations, such as due to a war injury, and the DWP has written ridiculous things back saying, oh, is this going to get better? I knew it was going to be bad from experience. And I remember people around me were going, oh, stop being so bloody pessimistic and all that kind of thing. I think disabled people are just realistic. I don't think we're pessimistic because we know the game. So it's the thing where I like to joke about this sometimes. My eternal curse is sometimes I come across as too normal. So in the respect of I'm talking to you and I've set this up so it's an environment where I can effectively succeed. You do not, however, see the preparation or how I've adapted because this is a Zoom call. It's enough so that, sorry, recently my sister had such a great line to me where she turned around to me and she said, careful, Lydia, your normal is showing. Just to further underline this. I knew, but because it's also the thing of, I feel hidden disability is also not talked about and it's not really considered in the same sense of physical disability. There is definitely a hierarchy, particularly in how we deal with this as a state, as the UK. So it came back and it basically said, oh, you can just learn how to do this. I could just learn. I could not be autistic. Just this really ridiculous idea that I can change my entire neurology being the whole way of being, so my brain, personality, body, etc. Because there is it's the thing as well where we often forget that there is, just to make a sort of philosophical point, the mind and the body do sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah.
My ASD definitely impacts me in that sense. So it's things you can't really see on the Zoom call. When I'm very tired, for example, I technically have a hand tremor.
Yeah.
You would not pick this up over a phone call. They insisted on making this a phone call and not making it an in-person assessment. It also impacts my motor skills. So it's things I have to buy adaptations as to kind of how to undo the jam jars because I just can't otherwise. Apparently, according to the Department for Work and Pensions, I could just learn how to cook. That it's just to really underline this, it's the thing of, you know, the Teflon trays that are supposed to basically be indestructible. Yeah, that's not really true, and I can prove that because it went once in my oven and never came back. That's how bad a cook I am. Okay, I mean, you can't. It's the thing of, there are so many different variables and all that kind of thing. It's the thing where an idea can sort of be sparked in the sense that there was just that one line of how I could apparently just learn to cook.
Yeah, and when actually that information isn't actually accessible to you, and it's never been made accessible to you in a way that you can fully comprehend, grasp, want to be able to deal with.
It's also the physical frustration. Element.
Yeah.
So now that I live by myself, I've been able to adapt my kitchen so I know exactly how to do so.
Yeah.
But it's that ridiculous idea of the Department for Work and Pensions would probably say now, we'll take her PIP away because she's doing well. But it's the fact that that's there in the first place that enables it. And yet you would, there's this, if you do the kind of mobility part of PIP, there is a line that says about physical disability that does not allow that to happen in a physical disabled context. It's not said for hidden disabilities. So I had this kind of very intense 4-day period where I was talking to individuals, texting, WhatsApping, as a journalist, but also as a friend, and also just being a nosy bastard, frankly. Where I was sort of talking to this kind of network that just sort of grew. And my issues in the issues, that sounds awful, my experience in the kitchen was very kind of, it took a shape, it had a universal shape to it. And it was the thing of where those 4 days I was staying up into the very early hours, just scribbling in a notebook going, got this idea, how can we make it hang together? So I pitched the book. That happened. I spent, I think it was 9 or 10 months writing it. So it has 100 it has 100 recipes, 30 from other autistic individuals. The recipe format has been revamped. It has vegan, it has vegetarian. It's also illustrated, so it has kind of sensory issues, taking those into account. It's got things adapted for executive functioning. Part one is to take on the accessibility of a kitchen, because we do not have a language to talk about it. And it's the thing of where so many individuals were wanting something that they could go, Mom, Dad, I need you to read this to actually understand and to give you the tools. So it just amazed me, like jar openers. If I ever say that to an individual now, it's sort of like, oh my God, we're going to get this. This is amazing. We shouldn't be having that reaction. It should be standard. It was published in November 2022. It's since won two awards at the I think it's pronounced the Gourmand Awards. It's gone viral on TikTok. It's now a pilot course that I'm teaching down in Sussex. We hope to do more about this in future.
Yeah.
And at one point, I wish happily to retire from having to do this. Just because you said earlier, it should have been written earlier. But it's the thing of where it should have been written by somebody who was autistic, neurodiverse, etc. It should have been written by them, and it should have been done in an affirming way, and it should have been person-led rather than... Because there are sort of efforts that I found online, but they're always at the convenience of people who are not disabled or neurotypical. And it relies on this junk science of, oh, you can just, you know, cure your autism if you can just eat better. There were just so many of these books. Yeah. And it's sort of frustrating thinking, I don't get this.
My favorite that I've come across is you can cure your autism if you go gluten free.
Came across that one. And you want, it's, forgive me for saying this, but a lot of autistic people do have they have celiac disease, can't have gluten, various conditions like that. We don't quite know the link. It don't just make them normal. It's not like you come out all sort of singing and dancing type thing. This is just insane. It's like, I do not understand where there are actually individuals who sort of think into this sort of junk science idea. It's just not true.
And so with the cookbook and this pilot course that you're doing, you're giving an area, particularly when we think about cooking and we think about what that represents in terms of like the home and the family and like nutrition and nourishment, you're also giving it that different spin, not different spin, but you're making it accessible to where it's previously been inaccessible. Because when we think about cookbooks, when we think about TV shows that are always, you know, on like Food Network or whatever, they are inherently inaccessible. And when you think about like when someone's writing a cookbook, the person that they're not writing for is a disabled person. They are writing for themselves. And whilst that is great and you're sharing recipes, it's actually, like I said, it's inherently inaccessible because you're not thinking about the wider population who are going to like read this or come into contact with this. Like for me, for example, I really struggle chopping up things, like really, really struggle chopping up things. And when I like see a recipe that requires lots of chopping, I will move it aside because I'm not going to waste my time. And it takes me way more energy than anybody else. And it takes way more concentration. So to be able to have a cookbook, particularly because we have to eat to live, right? We can't survive if we don't eat. That's a fact. To be able to have that and make it accessible to people is kind of invaluable.
Well, thank you very much. So I will say, as a kind of a caveat to this, I cannot possibly account for every possible individual, and I got so much shit for that. So there were...
That's interesting.
Well, it's the thing where neurodiversity can be helpful, but it can also be unhelpful. So in that sense, I got this wonderful comment from, I forget who this was, that said, why didn't you make it the neurodivergent cookbook? Neurodiversity as an umbrella term has so many conditions, and the access needs of various different individuals clash with each other. So it would just go on and on and on and on. No publisher would ever publish that.
Yeah.
Because it would just, commercially, it would just be a failure of a project from the get-go. It just would not work. But it's the thing where also I wanted to, in the respect of I can't, at the, so at the time I had not caught COVID, so I was just an autistic individual. I can only speak for kind of that sector because a lot of it involved kind of writing under as I rather than sort of, I don't think objectivity sort of is a thing. It's, we're sort of in a post-truth age. So it was the thing of where having to put kind of like under the subject of I and then kind of sourcing everything and that sort of thing. It's fine for you to disagree, but you don't get, you do not get to disagree with a fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very simply, it just sort of, it would have been impossible. There's always, non-disabled people come out with this idea that accessibility is kind of like, it goes on and on and on. There is a point we will come to eventually. You cannot possibly be accessible to every single individual at every given time. But that's because the idea of inclusion, it is an ongoing topic. It is the kind of the tussle around that. It is the pull and throw. It is the thing that says, actually, we can keep improving. That's fine. Yeah. And yet, I don't understand why that's so hard to comprehend.
It's also what you just touched upon as well about inclusivity. And I always say this as like a, as kind of like a fireside reminder, is that everything has an opposite. So the opposite of inclusion is exclusion. So even if you try and be as inclusive as you possibly can be, at some level, there will be somebody that you're excluding from that, regardless of how inclusive you're going to try and be, because there'll be someone who doesn't fit your bill, or there'll be someone who is half in, half out. And that is, that's a really difficult statement to make. And it's a really unpopular statement to make, because we always want to be as inclusive as we can be. But at a base level, everything has an opposite, and the opposite is exclusion. And at some point, there are going to be people that get left behind, rightly and or wrongly. Even if we try and bring them along with us, there'll be something that happens along the way. And people also kind of, in the nicest way possible, need to realise that. Because you could be the most inclusive person in the entire world. It goes back to that idea of, you know, you could be the juiciest peach in the entire world, and there's still going to be someone out there who fucking hates peaches. Yeah, and that's what it does come down to. But, you know, like, whilst we're trying to be as inclusive as we can, we've also got to hone down and make it as accessible for the right people. And I don't mean for the right people as in like there is right and wrong, but with you talking about the umbrella of neurodiversity, it is too much to try and make it all inclusive for all types of neurodiversity, because like you said, there's contradictions there, and it would be a contradictory cookbook consistently. Like, there would be things that wouldn't add up all the time.
It would also be massively condescending to assume that I can talk for, you know, somebody who has ADHD.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly
the thing of, I want, it's the thing of, well, I want other people to write their version.
Yeah.
So rather than sort of, I have some reasonable skills as a journalist, but I cannot possibly do that in such a way that it is something cohesive. I have really quite mixed feelings for my debut book. It came out at a time that was, shall we say, difficult. It was written in a lockdown, so I did not really have any support whatsoever with the book. I did not have any kind of feedback. Nobody read it. It just sort of, it was the thing of, well, I wrote it, revised it, and then kind of like, oh yeah, bye, gone to print now. It was very, very strange. It's also something that was out of necessity. It was not, I did not have a lot of love for it, to be honest.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important point to make as well, because mostly when you talk to authors, you know, their first written book is the love of their life. And it's like the best thing that ever happened to them. And actually, it's really refreshing to hear someone say, do you know what? Like, I've got really mixed feelings about it, and I'm not sure that I love it. I also don't hate it. Like, I'm in very much like a two minds about it. And I think that point of view, particularly when we're talking about disability, particularly when we're talking about accessibility, is also really important, because we can be in, two things can be true at once, even though that's uncomfortable. And like, being able to recognize that is really quite important as like, as humans, right? That's not like disabled, non-disabled. To be able to recognize that as people is super important.
We also forget that very often, and it's the thing when I went to start teaching the, I feel bad saying students because they're all at least 25 years older than me. And it was one of the first things that I said to them, in the sense of, it is possible to hold two things in a tandem with each other, and yet very often I feel like we do ourselves a disservice. And it's that kind of idea, and the kind of the forgetting of it is responsible for a lot of polarization. So it's the thing now where you can say, oh, we as a media are a function that are needed, even though we are hated, but we can be doing better. We can hold the two things, rather than just sort of saying, oh yes, the press are the enemy of the people. I understand why we are hated. All I can just hear ringing in my brain, to be honest, is the phrase going, phone hacking, and all that kind of thing. I can completely understand. I went into this effectively because one of my earliest memories is sort of like, I can remember the Millie Dowler story happening. I can remember sort of at the tail end of the Leveson inquiry, and I can remember my mother basically knew I was autistic because I was at school, secondary school, when the trial happened, which convicted Andy Coulson over this, and it had Rebecca Brooks and two other people, I think. So I would go into my school library and read all the possible coverage of the day to try and understand.
Yeah.
That's how my mum knew I was on the spectrum. But it was the thing of it. It's the thing. I have a lot of time and respect for The Guardian in this sense. It was always the paper that I always wanted to write for and never have done. The reporter who broke the phone hacking story is one of the most interesting people I've ever met. Just because when it comes to interviews, there's always the thing of, I always try and ask the questions that either haven't been asked or that I want to, because in that sense, it's more interesting than asking kind of, who are you and what do you do? We just reprint the same thing over and over. There is very little originality, unless you get somebody like Elizabeth Day, for example. If you go and read, if you read her stuff that made her the person that she is today, it's just so interesting. I mean, she interviewed Robert Pattinson, and it was the funniest thing I've ever read, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm not actually used to talking this much. I'm serious. I sit at home and I type. I see maybe like two people max a day. I'm not used to talking this much. Or it's the thing of where she met Prince Andrew, for example, and when the BBC interview happened, her column was absolutely brilliantly done. And yet contrast this so very often with kind of like, who are you? What do you do? Why are you here? It's just sort of, it's very lazy. It doesn't get to the person underneath. Nick Davis was the reason why I wanted to be a reporter. And I know that's such a cliche thing to say for kind of my generation. It's sort of like, yay, phone hacking. That's the one. That's like the Watergate of our lifetime.
Yeah.
But we still have yet to sort of fully reconcile with the revelations of News of the World and other newspapers. We are still in a transition of kind of like, there's still very much an old guard who wants kind of like the old traditions versus a new generation. I don't know what will happen. We may not even have newspapers in 5-10 years. I feel it would be a shame. The world would be a lot darker without us, but we need to do better. We can hold this in tandem.
Yeah. I love all the points that you've made thus far about journalism, about disability, about everything that we've spoken about. It is really important that these conversations happen, and quite often we can get quite lost in them because they can either become way too academic and people get lost, or, as we've already touched on, they become unpalatable and they become kind of uninteresting, and they're not what we want to read about because it's unsavoury. So to be able to have this conversation, I've really appreciated with you, because we've spoken about quite a lot of topics, but in a way that I hope is accessible to a lot of different people. But I would like to ask, what is a piece of advice that you would give to a younger version of you?
A younger version of me? Nobody's ever asked me this before. All they can just see is sort of like this version of myself with the, I used to have a lot more hair and a lot curlier hair and massive glasses with big bushy eyebrows and all the rest of it. I think that the advice I would give to myself is do not waste time on arbitrary expectations. So,
oh, I love that.
So one of the things that I wish individuals could actually understand about what it is like to be autistic, there's two things actually. First of all, I wish that individuals understood the immensity of what it takes to talk. Mm-hmm. So people, I don't think I've ever written about this, and I don't think I've talked about it or let alone covered this, but I will now. It's very often we have this idea that communication is in this kind of binary stage of talking. So we've got person A, person B, and they sort mm-hmm. of ping pong from each other. Communication is not just that. It is a really mm-hmm. lazy assumption that we make. And I think this is one of the... So I don't talk to my biological father. He's not a particularly nice human being, in my view. Mm-hmm. But this is probably the only relatively impactful thing that I've only just sort of started to consider now that I'm older. He made the point to me, and this is very ironic because this is prior to my own autism diagnosis, communication is not binary and it's completely arbitrary to assume otherwise. So yeah. I cannot think, for example, of a news story where we've actually gone to talk to individuals who, you know, use an AAC device or they can't actually talk, so they have to use sign language or if they use sign language, it's always kind of like in a performative way. We've not actually incorporated, we've not gone to talk to these individuals. We, as a society, we have this idea that communication is talking. It is the exchange of ideas. It's not necessarily. Words are actually quite limiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wish people understood in the sense of how hard it is for me to talk. So this might, I don't know if this would prove shocking. My relatives might not necessarily remember this. When I was first being diagnosed, sort of like beginning this 3.5 year pathway, I read this book, which I gave to a relative of mine called Jessicat by Jane Dillon. It charts how her son had selective mutism and mm-hmm. how he was later diagnosed with what was then called Asperger's syndrome. Mm-hmm. My relative had this sort of light bulb moment almost, and I remember this very well. We were at Centre Parks and I remember exactly where this was, where she sort of did this thing where she goes, oh my god, this was exactly you when you were a child. I find talking actually really quite hard to do, in the sense of it's not just kind of like saying the information. I have to translate it up there to make it sort of acceptable, and I have to think about all the sort of the relevant social bits and how to phrase it, tone, intonation, inflection, dialect, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. I wish people understood that, because it is an example of completely arbitrary things. I was trying to explain this in connection with the second book that I'm writing, in how to communicate with somebody who can't talk.
Yeah.
Because it was the thing about, I was sort of talking to other journalists about this, and it was the thing where you would have thought World War III had started just by kind of like the reaction to go, oh my god, he can't talk, blah, blah. Why is that such an issue? Because we just adapt, surely. And it was, they were sort of like, the look of just absolute wonderment that they had as soon as they said this. It's not exactly like a brilliant prize winning idea. I just thought this was relatively normal. Apparently not. It's completely arbitrary that. The second thing that I wish people understood about to be autistic, and this draws back to kind of like the first statement of to be aware of arbitrary expectations and all the rest of it. So to have an ASD diagnosis is technically to be considered developmentally delayed.
Mm-hmm.
So not in a physical sense, but in a neurological sense of not necessarily meeting kind of you know, kind of like after a child is born and they have all the different stages.
Like different markers as to where they're meant to be. Mm-hmm.
So there is a developmental delay. And I wish people understood what that can be like and how alienating it can be. We have such arbitrary ideas of what you should be doing in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, etc. So I'm 24 at the time of recording this podcast. In just over a week, I will be 25. So all I can just sort of see when I look around is kind of all of my friends are getting married. They are thinking about trying for a baby or a welcome baby number two, or they've just bought a house. All of that sort of thing is really out of my reach. My 20s have been basically marked by a pandemic and major illness and having to undergo kind of like various horrible invasive things and having to kind of like combat ridiculous ableism in the medical profession just in order to live a life worth living. They've not exactly been kind of like, you know, and sort of Dolly Alderton wrote that book and put it on the BBC and your 20s is supposed to be kind of like drinking and partying and shagging around and all that kind of thing. I didn't really get to do all that. It's completely arbitrary that we have this idea that that should be the same for everyone. I didn't get to do that because it was, first of all, inaccessible. There were national and international events. And also, the body wouldn't let me. We have this idea of arbitrary expectations, and I include things such as ageism, sexism, and all the rest of it in that. If we just actually stopped and thought about the arbitrary expectations that actually define us in the workplace, wherever, or even in the kitchen, it's a completely arbitrary of why you must do a recipe this way, a lot could be undone and a lot of damage would not happen. I still feel, looking back at myself, I still feel kind of sad in a way that it took me a long time to realise that, but also in the sense of I feel kind of now sort of making up for lost time. I feel sort of trapped, to be honest. Like, well, what happens next? It just, it's very anxiety producing.
I want to thank you for being so candid and honest about the, like, your experiences, because as you said, like, talking for you is not always the easiest, and we've spoken for nearly an hour now, and I really want to genuinely thank you, because it's not easy to be put in a situation where I'm asking questions and we're just chatting, and as you said, you've got to filter and be aware, and I do really want to thank you for giving me the time and this space so that we can have these conversations. And I've only got one final question for you, and that is, Lydia, are you disabled and proud?
Of course. I think that there needs to be, we talk so much in the sense of, I always have kind of in my inbox or people that I come across with, people that say, oh my God, like, I didn't want to give my child this label, and we didn't have all these labels when I was at school. We're not, and I always want to say, but today isn't your day anymore. We're not at school. It's completely, that is an arbitrary expectation that you're putting on yourself and on your child. Yeah. The universe isn't the same anymore. It's a big wide world that you could go out into. It's actually something quite empowering. It's not, and at the moment, I've just sent my first issue of Disability Review magazine to print, and I was very sort of militant about this, about putting something about the SEN crisis in the UK in this issue, just to actually get to the heart of the issue. And one of the things that came up very often was that a child statement in education, it's very often the wording around it is just so interesting. It comes across as, this is a golden ticket. Why would anyone choose to be disabled? That is the question in the set that I would like to ask the ridiculous kind of non-disabled commentators. Very often they're in kind of like Times newspapers. I mean that in a general sense, I'm not actually thinking of specifics. But it's the thing of kind of like, if you, whether you've acquired a disability, you've been disabled from birth, or it develops through genetics or whatever means, it is completely redundant to have this idea of, oh, we'll just wait for a cure. you're going to be waiting a hell of a long time. You're going to waste a lifetime. Life is short. There is a wonderful universe that you could be exploring where you could meet all these interesting people, have all these different experiences, and just actually go out and see something that's different from your neighborhood next door.
Yeah.
So it's the thing of where, rather than just sort of, I even said this to somebody recently, if I had broken my arm and I went into A&E, it's really unhelpful to go, oh, we're not going to label that. So you go, oh, we think there's something wrong with your arm, but we can't tell you what it is.
Yeah.
That's just, this is, I do not even have the words to comprehend this. And it's also, I really want to point out as well, so under the autism spectrum diagnostic criteria, very often one of the points is the child knows that they are different.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just talk to pretty much any autistic individual, they will say, yes, they did have some self-awareness that they were not like other people. They just did not have the vocabulary to articulate it.
Yeah.
Now, I think that people should be diagnosed as quickly as possible, because mm-hmm. otherwise, if you look at all the data and all the research and all of that, there is such a weight in, you know, that you're different, but it's always written off of, oh, you're just a bit anxious and a bit angsty mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. And there is a ridiculous amount of kind of mental health issues as a result yeah. of this. If we're going to be kind, I hated that hashtag when it came out, just because it felt so altruistic and arbitrary. If we truly want to be kind, then we should be naming, the problem, and we should be doing something about it. I'm at the point now where I am not going to be put into a box anymore. I will not be kind of made to feel small. You will not squash me flat anymore. I will not allow this. I read this, the midwife Lee Hazard wrote this wonderful book called Womb, which is about, it's basically history of uterus, but in the front of it there is a quote that I forget who it's by, but she uses it, and the last line in it is, the body is not an apology. Why would I apologize because this is just my existence? It is arbitrary to sort of go around and sort of thinking, I wish I was like somebody else, or I wish I was not disabled. Disability is a neutral concept. It's time we started talking like that.
Lydia, I just want to thank you for coming on today and giving up your time and having this chat with me, because it's been so insightful and I've loved it. And I love everything that we've spoken about and how we've spoken about it. And like I said, thank you so much for coming on. I've had such a good time, and I hope that you have too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disabled and Proud. If you've enjoyed the show, then please give it some love by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps us to reach more and more people each week. Plus, if you've got a particular highlight, then I'd absolutely love to hear it. Tag me on your Insta stories @Disabled and Proud Podcast.